Okay, so this is lesson five, Peter at the Transfiguration. Before we get into that, I want to issue a correction. For one of the slides last time, I guess everybody's aware of the reference error is to Acts 10 instead of Acts 8. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is this slide. In the original slide that I showed last time, the part that's highlighted yellow originally said something like we're saved by grace, not works. Obviously, that's true. That what I was trying to capture is something really more like this, that we overemphasize the grace part of it and we say works don't matter. What we really mean is God judges things the way I do. And so whatever I determine is right or wrong, whatever actions I determine are acceptable, is God's judgment as well. And that does sometimes get expressed erroneously as we are saved by grace, not by works. But that was not a very clear way for me to express that. So I want to issue that correction and apologize for any confusion that might have caused. Also related to last week's lesson, based on the feedback that I got, we will be including some additional material in a later class addressing whether Peter was the first pope and thinking about that from a scriptural perspective. So I appreciate everybody's feedback. We'll be sure to include that in the class material. So we're going to talk more about the disciples' misunderstandings, misconceptions of what the kingdom was going to be like. And so I wanted to show these again and just kind of point out that it is easy, based on influences from the world, based on our own misunderstandings, to not quite understand what the kingdom and Christians, kingdom citizens, are to be. And it's something that we should take very seriously and look out for ourselves that we don't have these misconceptions. Our objectives for tonight are to be able to name the prophecies and cultural expectations. There's really only two of them. It should have just been prophecy and cultural expectation, but whatever. They colored the apostles' interpretation of the Transfiguration, and to be able to explain why Jesus paid the temple tax. And obviously we'll be drawing some applications from those as we go through. We're really only studying two stories tonight, and I'm going to use the accounts in Matthew primarily, although we'll be referencing other accounts as well. So if I could get somebody to read Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 through 13. And don't forget to unmute yourself.
I got you, Mason.
Thank you.
Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with them. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. For if you wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice came out of the cloud, saying, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and were greatly afraid. But Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise, do not be afraid. When they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. Now as they came down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is risen from the dead. And his disciples asked him, saying, Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And Jesus answered and said to them, Indeed, Elijah is coming first and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah has come already. And they did not know him, but did to him whatever they wished. Likewise, the Son of Man is also about to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptist.
Thanks, Austin. So, like a lot of the stories we're studying in this class, the stories are familiar, and we're also, our task is kind of not to understand the story in depth, but to kind of look at how Peter specifically grows as a result of the events that are happening. So we'll probably leave a lot of questions about this event in particular unanswered. But basically, you know the story that Jesus goes up into the mountain. Not really clear which one. There are lots of ideas, but to pray with Peter, James, and John. And I think this moment of prayer is critical. It's we know from stories we've already studied that Jesus goes out and kind of intentionally spends a long time in prayer before a key, you know, event or a key phase of his ministry on earth. This is really getting ready for the most critical and difficult part of his ministry, where he's going to die and where he's going to ask his disciples to do some really difficult things. And so a moment like this is for Jesus' benefit to spend some time alone in prayer. But also, he takes Peter, James, and John with him. The other disciples are probably nearby at the bottom of the mountain or something. And he is preparing them in this experience and in the discussions that will follow for the things that he will, the difficult things that he will ask them to do in the coming months. But I think he's also, it's not all negative. I think he must also be anticipating the glory of the coming kingdom. And that would have brought him joy to think of the great, opening of the kingdom that was about to happen, of the great salvation that would finally be realized and available. And I think that must have been on his mind as well, because it's the result of all the difficult things that are about to happen. When he's on the mountain, his appearance changes and Moses and Elijah appear with him. There are a lot of comparisons to draw here. His face shines like Moses' face shone when he came off of Mount Sinai. But the difference is that it's the difference between the sun and the moon, right? The moon reflects the light. Moses reflected the light that he absorbed from the glory of God. Christ is the source of light on the mountain. He is radiant, not reflecting light. And I think what we see here is Christ displaying probably not all, but some of his true nature, what the Hebrew writer calls the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his nature that Christ is. And so this moment, one other small detail that may sort of help us build this a picture of what's going on is based on the fact that in Luke's account, it says they came down from the mountain and the next day the crowd came to him. This may actually be taking place at night. I think the image that I always had was it was during the daytime, but I mean, think about what this would look like at night, right? With the moon and the stars, and you kind of see Jesus, and then all of a sudden, everything lights up, and he is the source of all this light that is lighting the mountainside. It must have been, well, it's clear from the text that it was quite an experience for the disciples that were there on the mountain. And as we think about their reaction, and Peter's reaction specifically, because he's the one who speaks, they all fall down, but Peter's the one who speaks. I think it's important to think about the preconceptions that the disciples are bringing to this event. They see Moses there, and they know that Moses has prophesied that a prophet will arise like him from among their countrymen. And so to see Moses talking with Jesus must have resonated with that prophecy in their minds. They also have this teaching that they will reference later from the scribes that Elijah must come first. So that's based on Malachi chapter 4, verse 5, and that is a real prophecy that Elijah must come first. But it's based on the way they asked the question, it's very probable that the scribes didn't have a clear idea of what that meant, that Elijah would come first. And in fact, if you look at contemporaneous Jewish literature, it's clear that they don't agree on what that is. Some think Elijah is the Messiah. Some think he's a forerunner. Some think he's part of like a messianic, group, that there's going to be Elijah and a suffering servant and a king, and they're all going to, kind of play individual roles or something. So there's confusion about this, and they don't understand that, but they see Elijah on the mountain. So therefore, if Elijah must come first, we've just seen Elijah, that means things are about to happen, right? And so it's critical for Jesus at this moment in his ministry to address and overcome his disciples' myths and preconceived ideas about him and his kingdom. It's especially important because he has only a limited time in which to do that. Now, I don't mean that to sound like a criticism of Christ's planning or revelation to his disciples. He's clearly revealing things to them as they are able to handle them and as he can kind of explain them fully. But he is running out of time, and this is this order in which events will happen for the age of the Messiah to arrive is something that his disciples need to understand in order to be able to tell people that the kingdom is here and the Messiah has come. So in thinking about these preconceptions, I want to go back to a slide we looked at last time, really based on 1 Peter, where I argued that when Jesus says that if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, that part of what that entails is not just stopping sinful behaviors or changing our habits, but it's actually changing the way we think about God and Christ and the word that they have revealed. And so in 2 Peter, we have all these things that Peter says we've got to stop doing. We've got to deny. And I think what we see in these, and there may be more than the six that I found, I think we see in these the roots of misconceptions that we have, which then ultimately become the roots of false teaching. There's a fleshly desire that we want, and so we then twist the scripture to make that okay. Or we just don't know enough to really, you know, understand what the scripture says, but we go ahead anyway, and we end up making a mistake based on our ignorance or our instability, trying to interpret difficult passages. Or destructive heresy comes in, and it sounds kind of appealing, and we're enticed by that, and we don't take a stand against it like we should. These are where the misconceptions come from, and you can kind of trace the things that the disciples got wrong in Jesus' ministry back to one of these. Sometimes they just don't know enough to understand what Jesus is saying, and so he reveals more things to them before he makes additional demands. Sometimes they're confused by the traditions of the scribes and Pharisees, these cunningly devised fables or destructive heresies, depending on, I guess, how much they bind them on people. And so I think we also have to be diligent to root these things out of our minds in considering what Christ has asked of us and in being transformed into his image. We have to change our actions, but we also have to change our thought processes. And I think that is really, we'll talk more about 2 Peter later in the segment, but I think that's an important point that 2 Peter has for us, is controlling our thoughts in these ways. Any thoughts or questions about any of this so far, I mean, specifically about the kind of misconceptions that the disciples are bringing to these situations? Okay, well, let's look back at the story. I mean, one of the questions that often gets asked when we study the transfiguration is why were Moses and Elijah the ones who appeared? Some of the answers are fairly obvious. Maybe there were some thinking through this that I had not thought about. Moses obviously prophesied the coming of Christ, the prophecy of a prophet like him in Deuteronomy 18. Moses gave the law to Israel, and Christ would give a new law to his followers. Moses typifies Christ over and over and over again. It's like almost everything Moses does, you can see something that Christ is going to do in his ministry, at casting that shadow of Moses bringing water from the rock or providing manna from heaven or bringing the law down. Or leading Israel out of bondage in Egypt. Moses also died and was buried, which is something that is about to happen to Jesus. And so in talking about the things that are going to happen to him, maybe it was useful to have somebody who had that experience. Elisha is a model of John the Baptist, of course, Christ's forerunner. He's actually mentioned specifically, prophetically, as being that. But, I mean, one thing that characterizes Elijah is his all-consuming zeal for God and the law. In fact, you remember that scene where he, after the contest in Mount Carmel, he's basically burned himself out, right? Because he's been fighting so hard, and he's so disappointed that all this work he's put in didn't result in this great, rejuvenation of obedience in Israel. I guess if you want somebody on your side in a difficult moment, it's somebody like that. But he also typifies Christ's ministry and miracles, and it's a really fascinating study to see the correlation and the kind of threads that run from Elijah to Elisha to Christ, and how they build on each other, and Christ is the ultimate expression of those works and attributes. And then, of course, Elijah was translated into heaven, 2 Kings 11. He didn't die, and we'll talk more about maybe what that means in just a second. But I think both men together represent God's power to give eternal life, because they're both there, alive. They represent the old law's blessings, but also its disadvantages. Moses representing the law, which we'll be told in the epistles, was never going to be able to save us. Elijah representing a very disobedient time in Israel's history, where the law was just not sufficient. They both represent rejection of the leaders that God appointed. They were both rejected many times by the people who should have been listening to them, and that is what is about to happen to Jesus, and they could sympathize with him in that regard. But maybe most importantly, they represent, and I think this moment represents, the subordination of the old law to Christ. They appear representing the law and the prophets, but they're deferring to Christ, and they are acknowledging his authority. They are illuminated by his light rather than the other way around. There's more we could say about Moses and Elijah and about the transfiguration, but because the focus of this class is on Peter, I'd like us to sort of take the camera and turn it off of Jesus and Moses and Elijah and kind of turn it around 180 degrees and look at James and John and Peter specifically and answer this question. Why are the disciples even there? Like, they're not contributing anything to this discussion, what Peter does contribute isn't helpful. And I think it's telling that Jesus doesn't rebuke him. He just ignores him. He's just, we'll just keep going. We're going to ignore that one, Peter. I have a couple of ideas about this, but I'd be glad to hear what you have to think. One is, I think the disciples are there as a sort of, as a stand-in for anyone who would read the story, but I think that part of what they are intended to do in this is to recall similar moments that took place on mountains in these men's lives, right? Moses climbing Mount Sinai to receive the law, and of course, it's after that that his face shines. Moses climbed Mount Nebo to see God's promises spread out before him in the promised land before he dies. Elijah showed the glory and reality of God over idols at Mount Carmel. That's not supposed to be Mount Carmel. That's another typo. That's supposed to be Mount Sinai. After he flees, he goes down to Horeb, to Mount Sinai, climbs up on Mount Sinai, and he sees God's presence there. And I don't want to draw too fine a comparison, but I can't help but wonder if we're intended to see a parallel between all the noise and the lightning and the wind on Mount Sinai that Elijah saw, and then God wasn't in any of that. God was in the still small voice. It kind of, to me, it feels similar to they fall on their faces and they look up and it's just Jesus. He's just there by himself. Everything's is sort of as back to normal as it would ever be for these men having seen this. I don't know. But anyway, in any case, this moment here on the Mount of Transfiguration and specifically Jesus himself surpass all of these in what was revealed, in what in the glory, in the truth, and in the direction that was given. Just like at Mount Sinai, the law was given here on this mountain. A very simple, very clear direction is given to the apostles, which we'll talk about momentarily. Another purpose, I think, is that it was to help them better grasp his departure, which was he was about to accomplish. That's what the text says that Jesus and Moses and Elijah were talking about. And I think the disciples were intended to be here so that they would have some more tools with which to understand what was about to happen. Or maybe say it better, more tools with which to look back after the death and resurrection and understand it. Now, in Greek, when he says his departure, it's actually his exodus. The Greek word exodon is there in the text. Clearly speaking of his departure from the world through death. It's interesting that right before Peter recounts the transfiguration in 2 Peter 1, he also uses this word to describe his coming death. And it's probably just the word that you would use to talk about that, but it's interesting that it's there. Also, this conversation was intended to prepare Jesus for his ordeal and death, and it was probably good for the disciples to see that, to see Jesus, preparing for this great work that he would do. And again, I think they would look back later and say, okay, I see how God was helping him to do the work that he was sent to do. But, and this is the point that Peter makes in 2 Peter 1, it also became a landmark for Christ's divinity It became a landmark of Christ's divinity for the disciples. It became the moment they could look to and point to and say, yeah, that was the proof. That's how we knew for sure that he was who he claimed to be, was that, as Peter says, we saw him. We saw his glory on the holy mountain. But more, even in a broader scope than all of this, the fact that Moses and Elijah appear with Christ, these two men who are not living on the earth anymore, appear with Jesus, is a guarantee of Christ's promises about first his own resurrection, and then secondly, the disciples' resurrections, right? Because if these men, one who died and was buried, and nobody knows where he was buried, and the other who was taken up into heaven and transformed, translated, then what's going to stop God from either raising us from the dead or translating us into heaven when Christ returns? We have a proof of that in the life of Christ that the disciples, again, could look back to. And so when Peter talks about the certainty of the coming of Christ and the certainty of the resurrection and judgment, he's got proof that he can look back to in his own experience. And that's why I think in 2 Peter in particular, it's so important for him to establish very early in the text, we didn't make this up. We saw it. These things really happened. And Christ is who he claimed to be. So I want us to kind of take all of this and maybe make some applications to ourselves. But before we do that, is there anything else about the Transfiguration and maybe Peter's experience of it that stands up to you that we haven't covered?
Mason, is there anything to be made about his attempt to build these tabernacles? I mean, you said he just kind of rushed right past it, and there's probably wisdom in that. But, like, what would have been his reasoning for that?
Right. So the larger point here that you're making is that I didn't talk about anything past Moses and Elijah appearing and them talking, right, in my account of the Transfiguration. I have one idea about that. I'll get to it in just a second. But it's a little bit confusing, and I think maybe the best response to Peter's suggestion is the one that Christ gave, which is just move on. You know, it's the kind of thing that, and we've all done this, right, where you just say something and immediately you and everybody else in the room knows that was like the dumbest thing you could have said, right? And you don't even want to talk about it anymore, right? And if anybody says, why did you say that? You just go, no, don't, let's not talk about that. But I think there may be one thing to make out of it, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. Thanks.
How did they know that it was Moses and Elijah?
I don't know. What does it mean that Jesus' appearance was changed? If you can answer that one, I'll answer your question.
That wasn't mine. That was my husband's question.
Tell him to do his own dirty work.
Yeah, I assume they listened in on the conversations for a while because they knew what they were talking about, right?
Right.
At least, and probably more details about what it's like to get near the end of your life or finish your mission or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, is there significance to Peter using the same word to describe his coming death? I don't know. But it's curious. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like Marty said, if they're listening on the conversation, they know this, who this is, even though what Peter says may sound like a crazy thing to speak out. It's almost like if these are the guys, maybe we get them to stay around a little bit longer. You know, that just not this, you know, it almost sounded like he's planning for them to stay. If you're going to build something, even though it sounds silly, it's almost like they're going to be there for some length of time. Maybe that's some of the ideas there.
I definitely think it is whatever he intends by it. He is definitely informed by his misconceptions that we've already talked about. And among those may be a physical kingdom where the real Moses and the real Elijah are going to somehow be, players or something.
Mason, part of my question for even asking about like why Peter even would have thought of that is even in Peter's haste and when he says things hastily and he ends up being rebuked for something like that, even like there's still a layer of his questions that seem kind of endearing to Peter, at least for me personally. Like there seems to be some element of yeah, that's a good thought involved in some of the things that he says. And I'm trying to kind of piece that together here, but maybe there's nothing that needs to be said about it. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I feel like Peter has a lot of really good things to say, even in the things that he gets rebuked for, like drawing a sword or when Jesus has to say, get behind me, Satan. You know, like the things that kind of produce that, there seems to be some admirable thing about Peter in saying these things, even though it's wrong in the end, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, Luke's account makes it very clear that he said this because he did not know what to say and they were afraid. So being motivated by ignorance and fear, to me, that sounds like it's hard to end up in a good place if that's your starting point. But it's hard to know for sure.
I think these three apostles learned the fear that the Jews had at Mount Sinai when God was around it and the cloud came down.
Yeah, it's another parallel, right? They all fell on their faces.
Yep.
I should have put that one in there.
Well, I picture that Matthew says while he was speaking, the voice from heaven interrupts him, just cuts him off, and says, hear ye him in the end. And then, as soon as that happens, the other two characters disappear.
Yes.
So it seemed like that's a pretty graphic response, interrupting his statement and kind of taking Moses and Elijah away. To James's point that I guess they're not going to stay for a while, you know.
Right. Right. Yep. Okay, so I'd like us to think for just a minute about our own the lessons that we should learn. This is one of the questions in the lesson, and so I'm going to attempt to break us into groups. We'll see how this goes. Let's see, there's 18 of us, so let's do six rooms. That'll be three in each. That should be pretty quick. And we'll have about 4 minutes to answer this question. What lesson should we learn from the words spoken by the voice from heaven during the Transfiguration? In your lesson, you can look at 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 16 to 19. For some additional ideas. Well, hopefully everybody will rejoin us momentarily.
Yep.
All right. We'll have a few more people joining us in about 10 seconds, but somebody want to go ahead and share something that your group came up with?
Well, these are men, the three up there, that were just like you and I. And they were not gullible. They didn't believe a fable. They saw what they saw. I saw Moses and Elijah back, although they died. And so it sort of makes God real because they saw him and they saw the things that happened and they touched it and felt it and was terrified by the cloud that came over them. So I think that's one thing that we can learn out of this.
Good. The core lesson, right, which Peter needed to learn was to listen to Jesus. That's who is the source of truth. Very good. Anything else?
The other side of the same coin is that there's a kind of a validation of Moses and Elijah that's occurring here. I mean, they're called to be with the Son of God on the mountain, and maybe that's related to 2 Peter 1, that passage you pointed us to, where he's just saying they spoke as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. They were not just men speaking or following fables either, right? And so their right. appearance there, even though Jesus is emphasized as the new spokesperson, hear you him, but they were actually validated to some extent by their own appearance and all on the mountain.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So, one in kind of thinking about applications, I sort of found myself, you know, observing the difference in Peter between the moment of the Transfiguration and kind of what he describes in 2 Peter chapter 1, and some of these we've already talked about. On the mountain, he didn't know what to say, and he kind of spoke without thinking. But in 2 Peter 1, he has, by the time he's writing this, he understands what the Transfiguration means, which is what we've just been saying, that Jesus is the one to listen to. On the mountain, he's, you know, of course he's awed by Christ, but he's also awed by Moses and Elijah. That's why he wants to build tabernacles for them. But in 2 Peter, he doesn't mention Moses and Elijah. And there's, you know, his main focus, as ours should be, is on Christ. On his appearance and his glory. And this is to Dustin's question about why build tabernacles, you know, perhaps with some kind of messianic kingdom idea in mind, he apparently wants to preserve this moment indefinitely. Like, let's just live here. maybe it's just the six of us, maybe it's everybody, but, you know, let's make this a permanent thing. To preserve that one moment of in time in Jesus' ministry and not move forward from there. But in 2 Peter 1, knowing what will come, what comes after this moment in the ministry, Peter is now looking forward to the ultimate revelation of Christ's glory in verse 19. And, you know, as they come down the mountain, Peter says, all the disciples say, but Peter was among them, you know, why did the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And the implication, I think, is that, like, okay, Elijah has come, and so now it's time to do something. It's time to start the revolution or, you know, gather an army or something like that. And in other words, Peter is ready to fulfill what he thinks the scripture means. He's ready to just go for it. But in 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, he says, no, prophecy is God's to speak. Men spoke in the past as they were moved by the Holy Spirit, moved by God, and it's fulfilled in God's time and in God's ways. And I think the application is it's not ours to choose when a prophecy is being fulfilled. It's not ours to choose when it will be, and it's not ours to choose how it will be fulfilled. And so I think these are all lessons that we can learn as well to not get caught up in the moment, but to look forward. To focus on Christ, to wait for God to do things in his own time. Lessons that it seems that Peter learned from this great experience. And what we'll see in the coming lessons is how Peter achieved the growth that happens between the moment of the transfiguration and the writing of 2 Peter chapter 1. And it's not a pleasant transformation, as we'll see. So anything else about the transfiguration? We're a little bit over time, but I do want to very quickly cover the temple tax. So the temple tax is a very short story. They come asking Peter, does Jesus pay the temple tax? Peter says yes, goes and talks to Jesus, and Jesus says, well, no, I really don't have to, but we'll pay it anyway. And so Peter goes and catches a fish and finds the coin that he needs to pay his tax and Jesus' tax. In the mouth of the fish. So according to the Jewish traditions from the time, every head of household paid a 2-drachma tax. It's about 1 day's wage for the support and maintenance of the temple worship. It might be based on this law in Exodus 30, where God says to Moses, you don't count the people unless you have them pay a tax, and that is to redeem them because you're not supposed to pay a tax. I mean, you're not supposed to count the people. It could be that. That's compulsory, though. In the first century, it seems like they may have taken this rule and said, well, what we'll do is we're not going to count, but we'll all kind of pay this tax. So it's voluntary, but it's kind of expected. In some ways, it's a little bit like, you know, making an offering on the first day of the week. Like, you don't have to do that, but if you don't, you kind of like, if you forget your check, you know, or you kind of look around, or if you notice somebody not putting something in, you think, what are they doing? Why aren't they contributing? You know, it's kind of probably something along that line. Maybe I'm the only one who feels that way, but I don't think so. Jesus, in response, points out that as the son of a king, he's exempt from this tax. God doesn't have to pay for his own worship, and the temple and its worship were for and to Christ. And it recalls Psalm 50 that, you know, I don't need anything from you. I'm not hungry. What I need is you know, your thanksgiving, and I need you to live in an acceptable way. Then your sacrifices will be accepted. You know, Christ didn't have to pay for his own worship. And yet, he provides for the tax to be paid. It's interesting that it's paid for effectively by the natural world, right? He catches a fish, and the fish has coin. And there are lots of debates about, is this a miracle? You know, I think what we have here is the natural world that Jesus created and owns providing for his needs. But the important point is that he did this to prevent offense so that he wouldn't be seen as unrighteous or irreverent by others who are observing him. They won't be able to say, well, he doesn't care about the temple worship. He doesn't care about worshiping God. And in doing that, he would minimize discrimination toward himself or his followers. Oh, you know, you guys aren't real. You're not real Jews. You don't care about the temple worship. therefore, I'm not going to listen to your crazy ideas about the Messiah. And then along the same lines, to remove stumbling blocks for Jews who might believe, if someone bound under the law, Christ is following all of the law, then it makes it that much easier for someone to see how he fulfills the law and surpasses it and institutes a new one. And I very quickly want to make just a couple of applications about our rights, because that's really, I think, what we should learn from this story. I wish I had time to go through all of these, but I guess I'll just highlight the last one, that true submission to somebody else is good by doing something we don't have to do, like Jesus paying the temple tax, giving something up. Just doing it and then complaining about it, or sort of like restarting the discussion at regular intervals to see if you can talk the person into whatever you feel like you don't have to do, that's not the right attitude. Jesus doesn't tell Peter, pay the tax, but make sure they know that I really don't have to. And in that light of how we feel about our rights and how we act based on our rights, I think the simplest way of putting it is just the way Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 8:13. If eating meat causes my brother to stumble, I'll never eat again. He doesn't say I'll never eat meat, but I'll miss it a lot. You know, I'll never eat meat, but I'm going to let everybody know how much I'm giving up. If meat causes my brother to stumble, I'll never eat meat again. That's the example that Jesus set for us. I don't have to pay the tax, but lest we offend them, we'll pay it. It's a good lesson for us as we consider the things that maybe are allowed, but not that not everyone is comfortable with. All right, so our objectives, prophecies and cultural expectations, Moses' prophecy from Deuteronomy 18, and scribes' teaching that Elijah must come first. Those are not misconceptions exactly, but they colored their interpretation of what was happening at the Transfiguration, and Jesus had to help them work through that. And then explain why Jesus paid the temple tax. Again, reasons we've just discussed. The key one being to make it as easy as possible for people to accept the admittedly difficult truth that he had come to teach. Okay, I apologize for going a little bit over time again. We got started late, so that's my excuse, but that was also my fault. Anyway, thanks for your attention, and we'll see you on Wednesday night.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mason.
Thank you, Mason. See you guys.
Bye.
Thank you, Mason.
You're welcome. It's good to see you.